I want to share a book with you first, and it's on this whole subject we're going to talk about, and it's one of the most beautiful books, and it's, I think they have, I haven't been in the bookstore yet, but I got this here, and they usually have it. It's Listening to Nature, and it's by old Joseph Cornell. He's got a better known book out called Sharing Nature with Children. It's got a whole lot of exercises, and if you have children, or you teach and you influence children, it's a must in your library. But it's a beautiful, beautiful picture book. And it has, some pages are just a quote like the one I read. But there are little exercises scattered in through here on how to sense nature. He calls it listening to nature, but when you read it, you'll see that it's all the senses. Listening's only a part. But that's really a beautiful book. Beware of the books. This is before we get started in sensing. Beware of a lot of the books that are being written on this whole generational subject on spiritual ecology, new theology, and it does. You know what you'll start to find, because I've been acquiring those books because of this emerged awareness in my own life of putting some identity to the spiritual value I always had but didn't talk about. They feed on each other, like so many books on new topics, relatively new topics. And most of them are anthologies of everybody else's writing. You'll get into it, and they're quoting all the other, you know. In fact, all the stuff I have on Matthew Fox are in books written by somebody else. But what they did is glean out some real nuggets, and so I get my nuggets. Same thing with the one on Mirror. I don't have to read 500 pages of Mirror to find the nuggets, because this good friend here made the Christian connection of Mirror's observations and teaching as a scientist. The other thing I'll wait for the closure to talk about a recommendation about Mirror. Okay, sensing. It was my observation in all the years, some 45 years longer, of traveling the mountains, much of it alone, except for my family on only one occasion or other members of the Forest Service on horse trips and members of the planning team. But even then, we split up. We didn't spend a lot of time together. But the only time in my entire life I've ever traveled in wilderness on an overnight trip, let alone an extended trip, was once. And it was a follow-up to one of these sessions. We had about 18 people. We had deep snow 4 years ago. And wonderful chemistry happened between us all. And I use slides I don't use anymore in a read the land thing I do inside. But it takes a whole hour, and I didn't want to take that much time for just visuals. And so I had used it at that time and shared a trip that my family had taken right up here in the high country on the ridge that parallels the lake as you come up, and looks so rugged and forbidding. But it's uplifted geologically from the south to the north, so you're looking at the break. And the back is all just welcoming country, open and wonderful. So they fell in love with the pictures and the slides. And, oh, could we someday go there? How do we get there? And I said, why don't we have a follow-up retreat? So the young preacher, Jeff Merkel, came out from Philadelphia that summer. 9 of the people showed up. 7 of them, 10 of them. 3 of them were experienced. 3 couples had never been to the mountains with a pack on the back of their life, and they rented equipment. And I made a really, we started at 6,000 feet. That's the wonderful part of this. You don't pump up the dream. So we spent 2 nights and 3 days up in the Pyramid Peak country as a follow-up to this session, and had Sunday services led by Jeff up there, and we had a nighttime sing. I can still remember Amazing Grace chorus after chorus around the campfire. Only campfire was mine. We all camped separate and spread ourselves all over the mountain. I'll talk about some of those techniques can enhance your ability to see and perceive and smell and hear and touch. But that was the only time I've ever traveled with people other than my family or traveled alone. But I observed, because I was in the business, and I didn't manage the use of wilderness for myself. I managed it for the public owners. I had to know the customer. And so I studied them a lot from distant places and then talked to them. Did a lot of just stopping on the trail and talking to them. And purposefully in uniform, because you have a different conversation. It's interesting. They would reveal things to me. If I were in uniform, they wouldn't tell what they thought was just another passing backpacker. In fact, most times they wouldn't stop talking. And they wanted to share. They saw me as their custodian of all this. And which I wasn't, but they saw me in that light. And so I learned a lot of things. What I learned most is they didn't see much, and they didn't hear much, and they didn't feel much. They thought they did, and they wanted to. I ran into two backpackers that were on their way from Mexico to Canada on the Crest Trail. Now, almost everybody you meet on the Crest Trail will tell you that's what they're doing, but then when you check and you see the REI stickers are still fresh on their boots, they probably did start it yesterday at Stevens Pass. But you know, that because the trail does that, a lot of people fancy themselves on these long-distance walks. These two were definitely doing the trip. So I really want to talk to them and find out, you know, what their experiences have been. What I got was a litany of how far they traveled each day. And, you know, bragging was 26 miles through the to them, monotonous stands of lodgepole pine on the Bear Springs district of the Mount Hood, and understand all this, every foot of that trail is familiar to me from different jobs and assignments, and not because I ever walked from point A to point B, because I don't, and I'll counsel you not to. But that's all I heard from them, you know, how far I went. And, you know, it was this big macho exercise. Ask them, you know, how they felt about the passage across places that were beautiful and known to me, and the snow grass flats and the goat rocks, or across the slope of Mount Hood, past very near to where that windblown tree is you saw in that last slide. Really unbelievably gorgeous places. They couldn't recite what was behind them, and wanted to know what was ahead of them in terms of miles. And plan camping spots. Okay, forced march, you know, a little better than Bataan, but not much. And people historically seem to do that, even on day hikes. So I thought, this just isn't the way it ought to be happening, and it's not how I'm doing it. What's different? The differences are these. I'm going to get in a whole bunch of Busher's rules of travel, and so I won't do those first. But it's, first of all, in disciplining yourself that you want to perceive that nothing is ordinary and nothing is repetitious, and unlike our driver, that is not a boring drive, because every inch of it is different. There is no monotony in nature. Even lodgepole pine stands are terribly individualistic. None of us look like each other. We're all different. He's handsome, I'm ugly. She's got hair. I don't have hair. You know, I mean, we're all different. He's a great big guy. Someone small. We see the individuality in people, and we react to it negatively and positively. Unfortunately, negatively. Most people, this is no accusation, say, because there will be exceptions in this room, and there will be people that are as good at perception as I am. But most people that travel in what is really foreign ground, an occasional visit relative to the rest of the place we spend our lives, just quickly get caught in a routine of travel, of transporting themselves, even on horseback. Horseback's really great. The latter part of my career, spent a lot more time on horses and let the mules pay me back for all the backpacking I did, because you're up higher and you see more, and you really don't have to worry about your feet, and you don't have to worry about the horse feet, because they're smarter than you are. And so the, you know, horse travel is really wonderful. But if you get in the routine, you'll be doing the same thing as if you were walking and carrying a pack. You just still will not perceive. You'll see grand landscapes ahead of you because you're up above the brush. But you're even more removed from contact with the earth and the plants. And that single bloom, the first orchid you saw that year, you know, you walk right by it. I sat right here next to about six orchids last spring when I had the elder hostels, and I'd done my read the land thing. Then I wanted to see if they graduated or flunked. So I waited as they worked their way back through, and not one single one of them saw this little tiny bunch of orchids until the next to last lady who was in a, with a walker, because it's a walk, not a hike. And I encouraged her to come. I said, we will only travel as fast as you and probably slower, because we stopped to see you. And I coach from them. I don't interpret. I'm not an interpreter, because I think it's an insult to interpret things for people. I will give them scientific information after they discover the clues and start to reason out what's going on here. And the next to last lady out of 35 people saw those flowers. And all the 33 who were out there to see still hadn't seen them. And we're talking, you know, Calypso orchids, just gorgeous, but not obvious. So most people complain when they travel in the Cascade Range, they never see animals. But folks, trust me, the place is just lousy with creatures. And the reason they don't is because they're moving. The reason they don't is because they think the animal's going to be obvious. Well, the animal's not going to be obvious. It's the business of the animal to be inconspicuous, even the bears, and especially the bears. Black bears in the Cascades are shy. I've never had a problem with a black bear in my life because I don't go to national parks. And in parks, of course, they're not hunted, and therefore they have no respect and you have problems. But the black bears are probably the most shy. And they're not obvious, but you see, and cougars. I've seen a lot of cougar. And people testify they've never seen a cougar. One of my slides, I'm going to tell you a cougar story. I think you'll enjoy. So that's the first thing you have to do, and you have to work at it, folks. You have to discipline yourself, and the best way to do that is be in love with what you may see. And there's a nice passage in here, but to save the meager time we have, I won't read that now. If you get this book, you will find it and enjoy it. But it's to love what's around you, because what you love, you will see. To really care about and really examine your relationship. All these words we can spend here forever about connectedness and how we're a part of nature and all that, and then we go right out and behave like we usually do. That we're above nature and not see things and not appreciate. Not know. I was telling a couple of you to go on with the earwigs. My knowledge of that comes from a wonderful friend, an ecologist, who has been spending his entire life researching life in down trees, specifically down Douglas fir. And he has learned so much that we should have known when I started my business and didn't. And would have showed more respect for the value of down woody material, the value, the critical value. He's found interrelationships. One wonderful one is my story about the carpenter ants. Carpenter ants, as you all know, drill away, and if it's in your house, that's not a real good deal, but on the log, it's really great. And what the carpenter ants are doing is, what are they doing? Oh, no, that's the result of what they're doing. What are they doing? They're doing what you do.
They're dogging tree down.
No. They're eating, sleeping, and making love.
Oh,
okay, folks? Remember, world isn't any different for any living insect out there, let alone larger animals. In the process, other wonderful things happen. They reduce the bulk of the material. Moisture gets in. Other creatures hold their both plants and animals. And finally, the log becomes a contribution to soil and fertility. In the process of doing this, the earwig has developed a relationship with the aphid. All you gardeners know about aphids. Aphids create honeydew from the sap of the plants that they live on. The ants harvest the honeydew and feed the eggs in their nurseries the honeydew. And they could quit there and say, thanks, Mr. Avid, that's real kind of you, and to furnish my grocery store. But they do more than that. In the wintertime, guess what? They cohabitate in their tunnels, in their galleries. They allow the aphids to cohabitate with them. They provide winter shelter to their friend, the aphid. Well, you know, these linkages go on and on and on and on. It's so marvelous. But you'll never know it if you don't see it. Why don't people get lost in Harlem, Ted? Well, I mean, people that live there, I get lost there. But why don't people in Harlem get lost? Or why don't you get lost in your neighborhood? How come you don't get lost when you're in town? How come you don't?
Because You just know it, or you feel it.
Yeah, you see everything. You've seen the board on Mrs. Morrison's porch that's broken. I mean, you know, you see everything. You know, read the signs, right? You don't get a little, you don't read it. You don't see a big article. Mr. Brown got lost in his neighborhood where he's lived for 40 years, and the police are out looking for him. You know? We don't get lost. It's because we perceive, we see, and recognize those things around us for no particular reason. How come people get lost in the woods? I mean, they get lost out there all the time. Why do they get lost in the woods? Why do people get lost in the woods?
Well, one reason, I think, for the scare. That's me. I know about one person.
Safest place I know is the Cascade Range. There's no plant that'll poison you. There is no creature that will bite, no snake that will bite you and poison you. There's scorpions, but you'd have to work to disturb them. Bears don't bother you, as I told you. I mean, it's the safest place I know. There are parts of Portland I won't go to, but no place in these mountains I won't go. But there is, yeah, there's a sense of fear. And some of the psychologists that I read say that's an important part of the experience, and I think it is. I call it risk-taking. Defining risk and understanding. Most things are not dangerous. Those things that are, you better respect. They will not respect you. But why do people get lost in the woods, really? Why do they?
Everything looks the same.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. Everything looks, every rock is the same rock. And that's how they get disoriented. I mean, we get really smart people. I've had, you know, experienced mountain climbers lost on Mount Hood. How can you get lost on Mount Hood? I can see Portland. You know, I mean, you know, and so they get in the whiteout. I mean, they get lost because everything becomes the same. And that's this product of apathy, monotony, and a whole lot of other things that happen to us when we get into a surrounding that's strange. To me, it should be more interesting than a place I'm familiar with. You got to care that, folks. It's in us, see? We also set unrealistic goals. We set incorrect goals. The goal to get somewhere rather than the goal to see what's on the way. Interesting story that's in here, and there's right and wrong ways to do interpretation. The wrong way was the traditional way for a long time. I'll give you two examples. If you're trying to help people understand and see nature, and this fellow happens to have a bunch of kids out, and he's done this many times, like I do my Read the Land thing up here, only I don't do it the way he was doing. He was getting the kids to kneel down, trying to get the kids to kneel down and study these holes along the stream bank and tell them that's where the little crayfish live and get them to extract a crayfish from his house and learn all about crayfish. And it was always very successful. All kids just love to get around bugs and they're all down there and getting muddy and dirty. And this time it ain't working. It's not working at all. I mean, these kids, all he's seeing is their knees, you know, but they're all just standing in the semicircle that they were in when all this drill started. And you know, he's kind of perplexed, and so he says, come on, kid. Nothing happens. Then he looks above their knees to their heads. Their heads are studying a great horned owl sitting 4 feet above their head that they saw and he didn't. He was in his drill. That's not successful interpretation. I was out on the volcano to give you the way it should go. And we have some of the most wonderful young people out there in that have come to that enormous opportunity we have in the National Monument to allow people to learn by self-interpretation, okay? They are coaches, as I said earlier to the folks came first. They're not teachers. They don't see themselves as teachers. They're modern interpreters. So what they do, they get a bunch of folks at a little place called Maida Lake. And at Maida Lake, the big blast, it's not far from the heart of the blast area. And the blast came up over the ridge, and it was an older stand of mountain hemlock and silver fir. Blasted it flat across the lake, and it's really dramatic, very dramatic landscape. All these huge trees are down, and we put this paved interpretive trail that carefully winds. We didn't cut anything. We took it underneath hanging trees, so you have to duck to go under. And the attorneys all said we'd get sued, and we told the attorneys stay in town and just leave us alone. And the Park Service would cut them, and we don't. Because you got to crawl under a down tree to know what a down tree is. If you cut two sections through it, you can walk through it. Come on. And so I found an engineer that put zebra boards on them on both sides. You know, zebra boards, the black and yellow, so people wouldn't hit their heads. I took the zebra boards off. I said, anybody so dumb they hit their head on that tree, there'll be no damage to either the person or the tree. So they guide these groups out there, and I'm with this one group to learn from these wonderful young people, because I volunteer up there to interpret. I mean, even while I'm still with the outfit, just so to have the so-called hands-on experience. But I learned how to do it well, and they are experts. So they take people through this walk. Well, all around you are these silver fir that are coming up. And they're nice and straight and tall, and they're growing like crazy. And in fact, in a very few years, most people are going to say, what's the big deal here? You won't even see the downed trees because that's forest. It's going. But this was 4 years after the blast. And there's all these green trees in this area that the trail goes through. So the interpreter asks the people, if they don't ask him first, well, if there was this big devastation, that's a word our folks never use. You know, we had all this devastation. Why aren't these trees killed? How did they escape? You know, it was strong enough to kill the... I don't know. Hey, you got any ideas about that? And it's almost always a child that comes up with a solution. Almost always. And it was in the group that I was following, listening in on. And they kind of come up with this idea. And well, they were young and tough, and they just bent and flopped. And no, that wasn't it. And finally, this little girl says, well, it was in May, May 18th. It was in May when the mountain boomed. And yeah. Well, way up here, there must have been a lot of snow. Eureka. All these trees. And the trees, by the way, see, this is why I have so much trouble with ancient forests and old growth and all this, you know, vernacular that's in the press now. So misleading. These trees were over 100 years old.
I mean, those short ones.
Yeah. And they were suppressed silver fir that are just tougher than hell, and they just stay in the stand until a natural happening exposes them to light, and then guess what they do? Boom! You know, I was taught in forestry school they don't release, as we call it. They do release, folks. They're growing 3 to 4 feet a year up there. And so all of a sudden, here's this, and that, same people start saying, oh, well, the Forest Service must have planted this, but, you know, we've already told them we don't plant anything here. Weyerhaeuser planted their part because they're going to cut it. This is nature, and it's working, and we're not. And so that's interpretation, discovery. It's learning by discovery. And so I assist if I'm involved, but you don't need assistance. I mean, you're very bright people, and you have all kinds of experiences, and almost all your urban experiences are transferable out here as far as the thinking process that helps you arrive at results. There's a tree up here I love to use. It's one of the first things because it's simple, and it's a ponderosa pine way at the end of its reign in this valley. There's a few above it, but sitting out there, and it's got two tops. And then there's a dead top in the middle. It's like a slingshot with a sight. And, you know, I stop and we look around, and I try not to draw attention to it. Sooner or later, somebody, you know, I just ask them, look for things here that, you know, that you don't understand or you wonder about. Hey, sometimes they got to look hard because they haven't been looking. Never been looking before. Oh, that tree's got two tops. How come it's got two tops? Well, you know, and then we go through the well, you can see where the porcupine girdled it sooner or later. And they'll soonly, most don't know it's a porcupine. That doesn't matter. Through discovery, you know, you can see something chewed right through the bark, you know. And then the tree, why did the tree respond? Why does it have two? And then we get down to a little tree. I cut the top off. And I say, come and look at that one next year. It'll have two, too. And we talk about this wonderful verticality of the bud system that the terminal bud always seeks in conifers, always seeks to get above, because every plant out there is competing for light. Okay, just like we do. Just like we do. And so they succeed by having a vertical bud, which has a meristematic tissue, but you don't need to know all that. That causes it to go vertical. When you take it away, one or more will replace it. And that's why you have multiple tops. But, you know, in itself, is that important? No. It's only when you keep chasing these questions and you begin to appreciate the dynamism, the mysticism, the magic. You could not be an atheist if you travel in that country and see. I defy anyone to do that. You know, science does not explain it. Science only gives us the clues to what's going on and why, but it doesn't fully explain it. And the magic of that is a religious experience. The next thing is I talk about see the individuality. That is really important because you are so right on. People get lost because everything looks the same, quote unquote. And there's so much more variety in a wild setting than an urban setting, in a created setting. I mean, there's so much more variety if you see. So much more individualism. No two trees out there look alike, but your first perception is they all look alike, even ones of different species. That's why everybody calls everything up here a pine cone, which is damn illogical because only some of these trees are pine, but they all have cones. So be logical. Your logic will work for you. Learn to listen, but learn to listen this way. Search for the first, you have to hear them. Once you hear them, then ask yourself, what am I hearing? I mean, the coyote was real easy. But you'll hear sounds that are not obvious. You know, the tapping of squirrels, and there's a whole lot of things. The beating of a grouse, which is nothing but wings on air. We used to think they drummed a log with their feet. Of course, they don't. But search out the source of a sound. You know, don't be satisfied you just heard something. You want to know what made the sound. You know, I'm not a birder. Because knowing the names of everything is what us humans named nature is not real important to me. I mean, I know lots of names because I needed to for some reason. But to just know the name of everything and that we gave it is not real important to me. I kind of like the birds that are blue to be called bluebirds. And any little bird that's in the bushes I call a brush thrush. And I just appreciate the creature, and I don't worry so much. But birders learn to listen, because that's how they distinguish and how they find and how they see. The first thing they usually hear is sound, not sight. And so, you know, that's a real good pursuit for those that love it, because it does really pick up your awareness. Same thing with smell, with scent, not odor. But there are also odors out there. There are odors, which is kind of negative, and scent. Learn to discover what they are. You know, in the spring, why does it smell so sweet up this valley? You know, well, it's the cottonwood. You know, the flowers of the cottonwood and the oils of the cottonwood, and all you have to do is pick up a cottonwood bud, of which are all bud scales, which are all over the ground, smell one of those, and you know forever where that smell came from. You know, but the whole air is full of it. Same thing with this really sicky, sweet that my wife can't travel through in a hot day smell of a ceanothus field, you know, the snow brush that comes up after fire, which is up the valley. And if you can really get, you know, it becomes an odor from a distance, it's a sweet smell. So search and ask yourself, what's going on here? Let me go to the slides, if you turn those on, please. And this is an exercise. It's also in the book, but it's sort of, but it's something I've done for a long time. And it is called, he calls it expanding circles, seeing and expanding circles, okay? To me, it's progressive seeing. And I'll give you an example. First of all, there's a rare and endangered species, a bald eagle. And see, now you wonder what I did for a living? I stood around on mountain tops and just looked at all this wonderful country. I just threw this in because I was out there to see. I had a helicopter land me down here at a lake called Lake Carolyn. Well, I travel a lot by helicopter. Believe me, I've been to 700 lakes and the 700 lakes of the Alpine Lakes, and I didn't walk all of them. Because to do the study and to see the land, helicopters are wonderful. But he sat me down, and I sent him home. And I'd already had somebody in the district drop a rig about 11 miles away, and I headed across the country because I was there to become and be able to testify an expert witness because we were buying that lake. It was privately owned for the Alpine Lakes Wilderness. So, but I was also looking for some old CC trails that an old ranger told me were in the country. Here's the trail, by the way. You can maybe see the thread. That thread goes through there and down Jack Creek. And I never used any of them to get where I was. I just wandered. Not climbed, just wandered. And so I was there to see. I was paid to see and be able to testify expertly on all the aspects of the land. But it's a lot more fun to do for fun. This is my favorite picture of my daughter. I didn't pose her. That's where she went. We set our camp in the Goat Rocks, and we'd been working hard to get up there. And she just wanted to sit and see. And she almost looks like she's superimposed and floating. But she was a great observer, and even better than my son. And She made friends with animals. She made friends with prairie dogs. Not prairie dogs. The marmots. They're like prairie dogs. And she helped us discover the social relationships they had. And she called them parties. But there are paths that lead to all their holes with their little colonies. And they come out in the evening and they visit each other like we do. And they have parties. You know, that's her best phrase for it, and it's the best one I've heard. And they show off their children. The does and the fawns in this valley in the spring do the same thing in the ball field. And you can identify who the mother and the children are. There are a lot of and even one set of triplets I've seen, because they're at such a low stress level from having cohabitated with humans through the mine period in here, or that respected them. And so, but they play out there, and it's just that ball field is a ball field for deer, and you can watch them, and you'll very soon know, because all the behavioral traits you see in children, the bully, you'll see the bully. You'll see the protectiveness of two sisters. It all happens here. And she taught me a lot of that, because she just loved little creatures, and she'd spend a lot of time looking at them. Okay, this progressive scene, expanding circles. Okay, it's a pretty landscape, very, very beautiful place. But for many people, the whole picture is the only picture. And I've found that in a lot of exercises I've done with people when I ask them to see things. The way to do expanding circles is first, sit yourself down, to put yourself in contact with the earth. It's really important. Who was the young man who was a mystic that was here in the village for some time and used to go every morning in bare feet up here?
Probably Brian.
Man. Yeah, Brian. He had the most beatific vision, you know what I'm talking about, in his face when he would walk up that road and back, and we would meet each other early in the morning when I'd be up there in the spring, and sometimes not talk, just pass, but we did talk about it, and he felt you had to be barefoot to truly be in touch with the land, and he always traveled barefoot, but get yourself in touch with the land. You don't have to take shoes off, and then the expanding circle starts in your immediate vicinity. And force yourself to ignore that beautiful mountain and all that's out there and all the wonder of the great scene, and expand your horizon slowly and see what's a few feet and a few more, and then encompass the whole, and then retreat back. I do. You didn't talk about that, but decreasing circles is, that'll bring you back to truly seeing what's closest to you that you can see best in the scene. When you come back the second time, maybe the butterfly is there that was there and you didn't see, or the little vole that's in your field of vision you didn't. Things will reappear or appear that you did not see the first trip out visually. Tell me what you see here, practicing as poorly as you can on a slide, projected slide. Try the expanding circles approach and decreasing, and then I'm going to ask you something. Just do that.
Explain what it is we're supposed to do again.
Start by viewing, picture yourself as seated here, viewing the near plants and landscape, and then slowly gathering the whole, and then retreat back. What's the most remarkable thing that you, most remarkable in that view to you, and perhaps something you question, if anything? Yeah.
That there's brown grass in the foreground, and then there's brown brush.
Good.
And there's green sage and blue or something.
Yes, it's sage and blue.
And
you're correct.
The road is that is brown in front here and green there.
Because the sage, very good perception. The sage blooms the earliest. This is the High Oregon Desert, and it's early spring. The grasses, if you were actually sitting here, you would see the first green prongs of the replacement grass. This is the overwintered grass. It's the cured grass. Yeah, and it's bunch grass. And so then as you get out here, this happens to be there's a slight wetland in there. There's some color. Okay, but carry it to the whole expanse. What else you see?
Looks like there's no snow on the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right. That in itself tells you what time of the year it is. Okay. And of course, I think you quickly realize you're looking south, you would figure that out. Because this is Mount Jefferson, it's a maritime mountain, okay, and the wind cuts across the top, and this was all frosted with snow, but it's very steep, it's the first to leave, these are glaciers and permanent snow fields, and so hence the snow, it's already witnessed the first melt, but a lot more snow will go than that. What about the clouds?
Yeah, an interesting cloud.
Why did I even include them in that picture? Why would myself, the photographer, find that much sky and, you know, that much horizon or that lower horizon in the picture? It's not all that common. Why did I compose that shot the way I did? What's special to me about those clouds?
It's really pretty, but I also think there's a storm.
Lentigy?
Yeah, they're the lenticular altocumulus. This particular one, when I came through my old ranger district and was on the way to Bend, this one was up perched on the mountaintop. And they release and they drift off and another one will form. This is the front of the storm that will come. I mean, the storm's a long way away. But these are the low signals. This one will come, form another lenticular cloud, and so it goes, and there's your telegraph message. Beats watching the evening television and satellite photos. It will tell you the weather change is coming. Try this one now. You're down here sitting in the lush grasses with a wet bottom. But take that landscape. If you didn't practice expanding circles and only looked at it as a whole and we waited for the next slide and said, yep, nice, pretty picture, pretty place. Next. What would you not have seen that you see by, if anything, if you see by practicing expanding circles? What would not have impressed you as much?
A log or something in the wet grass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah, the rock.
It's a rock.
It's a rock, but it doesn't matter. Could be a turtle. What else?
A little rise in the middle.
Yeah, the little rise, exactly. This little perched landscape. See, what we're looking at here has a source. There's no way in this picture you could know it. But what this is tumbledown. I love to call it. It's a good non-geologic term. Stuff that tumbled down the mountain. And tiny example, little larger example. Larger example became a garden.
Oh, a rock garden.
Yeah, in exactly, a rock garden. I love it. And in an area otherwise inhospitable to broadleafy plants or conifers. It's a wetland. And they can't survive there. It's too wet. But this gave them enough dry land, perched enough. All that you see, instead of just, oh, picture, nice mountains, nice trees, pretty sky. Next. This one. We really need to drop it. Well, no, we don't.
Can we drop it down?
Yeah, can you drop it just a little bit, a little bit there? Bumper in the front. Okay, expanding circles again. You're sitting, catching your breath along this beautiful stream in Ewing Basin. That's great, thank you. Ewing Basin, a little way south here in my alpine lake, your alpine lake. Really practice it now. Really take your time before you go to the tops of those mountains with your eyes and your perception. Now, do some reasoning here of things that you see. Again, because we always see the background, we see the big picture, though we don't see it in detail, and this picture will help us do both. Do you see in the foreground?
That's not a dam, is it? No, it looked like a water dam.
Well, it's a natural dam. It's a natural dam. Okay. Yeah, what about the piece of wood?
Yeah.
Where'd it come from? Where'd it come from?
Avalanche.
Yeah, avalanche. That's all this. It's all avalanche debris. When avalanche has swept down that face right there, including the waterfall. Okay? This is snow deposition from the avalanche. Avalanche winds turn and carry the woody material. So you begin to self-interpret, to self-discover. To discover things that are there, not ignore them. Oh, piece of wood in the creek, big deal. It is. All is a big deal. It all fits together. It tells you things. It tells you if you come back there in the winter, and it's a very popular cross-country skiing area on McHugh Ridge right above there. In fact, there's a wonderful old couple that have some tent frame huts, and they call it Scottish Lake Skier, and you have to ski in to get to them. But, and this basin is very attractive, but that face over there is death waiting to happen. You read the clues in the summer, you understand the clues in the winter, you're okay. You can go there. What about the big picture up here now? We see a mountain and so on. But there's something really interesting to me in this photo that expresses itself to me as I really study it. And it's the whole water cycle. You know, of course, the water forms on the mountaintops by rain and snow precipitation, works its way down, goes to the ocean, evaporates, comes back. That's the water cycle. But so much of the water cycle is right in this one. As you trace this back and you're back and way up here to almost this is a perch basin, but very close to the east-west divide of the Cascades, you see that very beginning of this stream, which ultimately enters the Columbia River, which ultimately, or the icicle, which enters the Wenatchee, which enters the Columbia, which enters the ocean. And you're at the beginning. You're at the place of beginning, and you're at the source, the snow, the rain. Only if you see it do you perceive. Now, same thing. Expand your circles of recognition and then retract. What in that picture that might have been ignored if you only saw it as a postcard or a picture in a book, but if you were sitting there, what would cause you to give special attention?
If the dead
trees.
Yeah, the down lawn, the dead tree. And when you follow in expanding circles, you only see this part, and as you work your way out through the flowery meadow, all of a sudden you find what? You find its location where it stood when it was alive, which is right there. Right there. It broke off. You can age it, you know, relatively easily once you know we have a whole system of identifying the phases that down materials go through in specific ecosystems. And you can also, this whole meadow was a lake. Okay, this is an old age lake, if you like, that is now merely a semi-wet meadow. And but you also see the margin of trees. And why aren't they closer? Why didn't they come out? I mean, you got young trees, not necessarily young. You got small trees. Why aren't they come out in the picture? What would you deduce if you were sitting there and you're really looking at that?
It's still pretty boggy. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Again, it's too boggy. That delicate balance that makes what we call edge effect. An edge effect, if you want to see wildlife, is a place to be. It's an ecotone. It's where two ecosystems come together. The edge of a lake and a forest. The edge of a meadow and a forest. There's two here, the forest and the subalpine. Okay.
And why would the trees be dead when it appears that others of similar size are still standing?
Why do some people die and some people live? Okay. All the same things. Happenings in their life span. This one here, this clump here, most probably is a root rot. Root rots occur in foci, as we call them, in about 50 feet in diameter, in that particular species, which is subalpine fir. These could well have been a combination of insect, defoliating insect, and disease. They always work together. Why not lightning? Yeah, but these two. Lightning doesn't always leave burn marks, folks. And lightning, only one in 1,000 starts a fire. White lightning, we don't think starts fires. Yellow or red, people call it red lightning. But Ted and I think it's yellow.
Does lightning necessarily kill a tree?
Oh no, not necessarily. But it can. But it always leaves you clues. These trees wouldn't have any of these branches. When that bolt of lightning hits a tree and you're near it, you get one of the most exciting experiences of your life. It's just like having a 105 howitzer lay around on you. And, you know, I mean, things are flying everywhere. It's magnificent if it misses. And the tree, you know, it's just taking a hit out there. And it may live through it, but it's going to give you some clues. So, no, that's why when I see all the branches and so on like that, probably insect. Probably insect. Blows them off.
Well,
I mean, it's an explosion. Pardon?
How do trees live if there are no branches?
Oh, it doesn't blow them off. Sometimes, you know, blows some. I mean, these are tough creatures. They're tough. They go through. Why? Let me take you another one. Let's forget the front, which we sort of concentrate on. Let's forget the pretty back, nice bumpy mountains. Let's talk about this middle band of the forest a little more. Why do you suppose the Creator designed these trees we call alpine in appearance, right? They are the clue to the alpine. Those tall, slender, narrow-branched, pyramidal trees, we love them. They're right here on the edge of the village. We have a special affection for those trees, people who spend time in the mountains. But why are they so constructed?
Snow.
Snow.
Oh.
These are in deep snow country, and they do not resist or carry a snow load. There's another reason, and it's a wonderful one that you could not probably know. And I only learned by fluttering around in my wonderful helicopter. In the spring, I flew over, not too far from this particular location by coincidence, I flew over a stand of widely scattered alpine fir. These are subalpine, but alpine fir, which are more widely scattered because they grow in an extremely harsh site and they need lots of space. I happened to be there in the very early spring. All the snow that had collected and kept cascading formed a donut at their base. And what is that donut for that tree?
Water.
It's its own reservoir. Ain't it wonderful? Tough to be an atheist. Take a look at this one. Yeah.
It looks like a high tension.
Yeah, one. Telephone. No telephone. That's Strawberry Lake and the Strawberry Mountain Wilderness down in Central Oregon. What's the most impressive thing about that if you really concentrated all aspects of that, if anything?
Shallow lake.
Yeah, it is relatively shallow. How about the tree that this photographer chose to frame with, which is an old diehard trick. Look how different than these, but how much like these. It's really interesting. That's a larch. How many do that? Or tamarack. What's interesting about larch or tamarack? Yeah. I once said they were deciduous evergreens. There's a wonderful oxymoron. They're deciduous conifers, okay? They lose their needles every year, just like a maple. And that's what this stand is here. And of course, before they do that, they turn golden, just like a maple. And this country is most particularly beautiful in the fall. But a very different branching characteristic. Well, these trees, I told you, protect themselves from snow by their tight, tough, leathery limbs and very short, stubby branches don't carry the snow past to the ground. This tree can have nice, feathery ones. Well, what's the clue to why it can do that in the same ecosystem that the other tree can? The fact it loses its needles. It doesn't resist snow. Snow passes through it and forms its reservoir all the time. So none of this is happenstance or without benefit or purpose.
Where was that?
That was Strawberry Lake in the Strawberry Mountain Wilderness, just out of Prairie City. I'm going to go through these quickly because I got to do my tips for the road. This is what I call the High Lonesome. I'm going to come back to that, but that's the High Lonesome. That's the holy grail of these mountains. Trails are wonderful because they build anticipation. Anticipation is an important part of a recreation experience, let alone a wilderness experience. Anticipation in this one, that last one, the anticipation here is because, though you can't see in the picture, you can see this trail. This is the Crest Trail north of Snoqualmie Pass. You can see the next 6 miles of trail from this point. And so your anticipation is, oh, look at that, I'm going to be by that very soon. See? And so that's one kind. Here's the common anticipation that I really coached my family. As you approach a horizon line, begin to build your anticipation for what's going to unfold before you. You know, those viewscapes. Well, what happened on this one? I barely have time for all my stories. What happened on this one, we came around this turn and there was a Tom Cougar laying on a rock looking at us.
Oh, wow.
Close as you to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the leader was a local ranger, Bob Hetzer, who worked a lot with this village. This is right up here in the south, just across the lake. And Bob was closest, and he sort of backed up. And his resource system is there behind him. He's probably, you know, work for him, so he's probably going to throw him in front of him. And he says, come on up here, Bush. He says, I need you. And I came around the corner, and then I saw the Tom Cougar. I mean, it was big-time excitement. I've seen Cougar, but never that close. And so I said, why do you need me? He says, well, he says, if he gets aggressive, you can talk him to death. You know, stop and smell the roses.
Say, Dick, could I add a...
Let me tell you about this. I'll give you my tips because we're going to run out of time. Go, Ted.
If just a lady came upon a cougar like that, and she said to her husband, up here in Holden Village, he said, that's one of God's creatures. Isn't that beautiful? And the cougar's about to spring on him, I think. So she says to the cougar, not thinking about it, just think about the nature of it, I love you. And the cougar stopped wagging his tail and went off.
Yeah. Go ahead and ready for love.
Yeah.
The message in this slide, I switched from my concentric circle. Okay, I'll give you my first message. Don't count your adventures by the mile. Don't count your adventures by the mile. Repeat after me. Don't count my adventures by the mile. Always stop and see and talk. When you get older, it's wonderful because you need the rest anyway. But the kids won't. I mean, even mine that grew up there and so on, you know, they're still kids and they still want to get miles and, you know, and exercise and all the rest. And boy, but if you learn to do this, don't count your adventures by the mile. Next thing is, do not get captured by the tyranny of trails. It's a strange thing to me that humans go to wilderness for a, quote, wilderness experience to get closer to the Creator, to find solitude, whatever a wilderness experience is for the individual, and they allow the works of humans to dictate their route. And that, many times, was a happenstance trail built by a sheep herder, a miner, or the Forest Service going to a lookout. And so leave the trails. My wife, when she started, urban girl from Chicago, felt she would never be comfortable off a trail, secure. And so we did it slowly. And then we got to the point we went completely around Mount Hood on this trip and never used the trail from start to finish.
What about damage?
And never lost any member of my family.
What about damage to the
No, animals? That's nonsense.
Really?
This whole thing about fragile landscapes, and you'll read all kinds of books, says, you know, don't get off the trail, don't walk on the flowers, unless you're in the Sierra Club, and we know how to walk on the flowers so it doesn't hurt them. That's what they do. They literally told me that right up here in Cascade Pass. But see, you pick your route. I mean, you don't trundle through sensitive plants. And heather is a sensitive plant. But that is not, folks, fragile real estate. That's the edge moraine of the Elliott Glacier. And it's in the beginning of its life. If you went back there today, you'd have a lot more vegetation. Don't get captured by the tyranny of trails. When you camp, this is the camp my son couldn't accept all that responsibility to get to. This is the very one. And we came up a big rock cliff and down below, there's a shelter, and there's Paradise Park, which is famous because it has a pretty name. I want to call it Mud Basin. And less people would find it. And lots of trails, trail junction, everything. So we worked and worked, and we got up here, but then you stay. You make it a place of residence. Okay, when you start talking about not leaving an impact, no trace, move the tent, move the campfire, resod the campfire, move 30 feet, but stay in the vicinity. Then you'll see the animals, and only then. If all you do is pick up and go, pick up and go, pick up and go, you see nothing. The animals won't approach you. A thing about this anticipation, this was on the return trip that we made up in the high country, Jeff and I and 10 members of our flock, and it was near where we camped for 2 nights. And it's Pyramid Peak, which you see, Lake Chelan is right down there. You approach it from the backside in this long grassy slope off trail. There's a trail, but we didn't use it. And as we approached the saddle, I told these people, now get ready. I said, this is going to be stupendous. So you can virtually see to Canada. And you'll see all the sawtooth I'm talking about, we're going up this beautiful grassy slope, and we're not in a line. We're all grass. That's another thing. Don't walk in lines. And walk your own pace. And so as we approach, and I'm getting them all ready, and we get to the top, and this huge view opens just back where I took this picture. And they're ooh, and they're on. This billy goat was standing right there. Right there. It was kind of like the kids in the owl, and you know. And the billy goat standing, and my flock was doing what I'd ask him to do. They were looking at the great landscape. I said, you know, this billy goat lives here. You ought to at least say good morning. And wow, they were in rapture. So I herded him because I got him to the top. I got pictures of him standing. You saw one in the pictures in there. It was the same goat. And I got him up on top of that rock, and I walked up, and I've always wanted to touch their feet. And I didn't want Kim wanted to do it. So I reached up finally, and I got a hold of that leather foot, and he lifted it, and I fell under. Then he set his foot on my hand, but he was pretty tame. But see, again, you know, there's more than the landscape. This is someone talking to the animals. Okay, this guy lives here in Holden, and individuality. I know this deer, every time I see it, I photographed it from when it was a spike. And I couldn't find it last spring when I was here. Him. It took me 50 minutes to get this picture. And he stayed in that place for 50 minutes. It's right up here next to the backpacker's camp before he did the ball field. Why did I need the time? I needed the sun to come up over my back and over the ridge back here and do what it did and reflect that pearly everlasting shadow on his leg and, you know, because I had a fast enough speed camera, I could take a picture, but it had been no picture. I waited. How do I always know this deer, though every year his rack is bigger? The part of him that makes him individual in this herd is recognizable to you. Do you see it? Keep looking. Ear. He lost an ear. He lost the tip of this ear. It's cut right off. Probably by a bite, probably fooling around when he was a kid. And but they're all recognizable. It's a very short time, and you will recognize repeated viewings of animals because they are very individualistic. They do not all look or behave the same. Only put this in to sell winter. Do not confine your travels to the summer, spring, fall seasons. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, my wife is an adequate cross-country skier to get around. That's my family. To get around, but prefers snowshoeing. She's not in a hurry to do anything or anywhere, anytime. Takes her time. Taught me to slow down and see. But winter is so special. I mean, it is just, there's so many wondrous, beautiful things. This same area in the summertime is inhospitable to humans. Without at least blood transfusions that you're ready to dispose of, because it's a wetlands full of mosquitoes. And in the winter, it's mystic wonderland. And few people have seen it. I talked about not going or not anticipating that if you've been someplace and you visit again in nature, you're going to see the same thing you did. I visited this place alone 25 years ago on Mount Gilbert in the Goat Rocks. And wanted to take my family back because it's a kind of a huge barnyard of elk and mountain goats and everything else. We camped there for 4 days, saw a lot of animals, and finally I said, well, let's go up to the glacier. I got to the glacier and found a lake. 25 years ago, the ice was right here. Right here. And this was and now the glacier is a glacier no more. This is a stranded ice field. You can see the crevasses, but it's no longer moving. It's shrinking. And, of course, snow seasons will change and it'll expand again. And the lake will go away. So that lake is born in my memory. That lake was born in my memory in 25 years. Now about not going back. My wife and I, as I told you, spent our honeymoon in Three Finger Jack, off trail, and absolutely beautiful place. And our camp was on a little wooded ridge. It comes off the mountain a little ways out here with Jack Meadows and a beautiful spring below it. Fall of the year, September 3rd, and the kids just begged for us to take us back to our honeymoon camp, and we weren't going to. Jane is not a go-back person, and you know, go forward, go new things. The past is never as you remember. But we finally said, okay, we'll take it. So on July 4th, 1968, we were making this trip in. Kids were full of anticipation. We got there, and guess what? It was wonderful to Jane and I. We couldn't camp in our honeymoon camp. A big avalanche came down and took that whole ridge of timber down. It was all just, you know, like felled and buck timber. And we moved, found our own camp for that experience. My wife's wedding bouquet I didn't even know she took it with her. Remember, this is a girl from Chicago. She took her wedding bouquet, put it in that little pack she had on the honeymoon, and it's on the top of this knob right here. We were at camp the first morning. She said, "I want to climb that." I said, "You know, I thought I really achieved something getting her to camp." And it isn't a difficult climb. We just walked our way up the grassy slopes and then worked our way up the ridge. And that's when I knew she had her wedding bouquet, and it's up there today in the Rock Cairn. And I've told every ranger that's had that district, you better not disturb it. So you can't go back. The place I proposed to her is at East Boulder Park on the state, on the Oregon coast. When you go there today, there's a cyclone fence that cuts you off because the trail, the asphalt trail's gone because the ocean took it. Okay? So those are, you know, life experiences that have taught me that you just can't count your adventures by the mile. Keep your travel options open. Never drop a car at Stevens Pass to go to Snoqualmie.